KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Direct talks are scheduled next week at the Egyptian Sea Resort of Sharm el-Sheikh to be followed by further talks face-to-face in Jerusalem between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. U.S. Envoy and former U.S. Senator George Mitchell has stressed that a framework tackling all core issues has been established. But what, if anything, will ultimately emerge from these talks remains to be seen. We'll discuss the potential prospects for a peace agreement in the hour ahead with a panel and your calls, emails, and online questions and comments. That's next on this morning's forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. The first face-to-face talks with the Palestinian Authority in Israel since Benjamin Netanyahu took office back in April of 2009 have taken place and will continue with former U.S. Senator and Envoy George Mitchell and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on September 14th and the 15th in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, before they move on to Jerusalem. U.S. Envoy Mitchell has stressed the establishment of a framework tackling all core issues, which he believes will lead to the working out of a set of principles and an interim agreement. And in this opening forum hour, we assess and discuss the ongoing peace talks, which were initiated by President Obama, between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Joining us from Washington is Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He spent two decades at the State Department and advised six secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations. His books include The Much Too Promised Land and America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. And good morning, Aaron David Miller.
Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Glad to have you here, and also glad to have Alan Weiner, who is a senior lecturer in law at the Stanford Law School and co-directs the Stanford Program in International Law and the Center on International Conflict and Negotiation, and he joins us from the Stanford campus. Alan Weiner, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Good to have you, and we also want to welcome Robert Malley, who is Middle East and North Africa Program Director with the International Crisis Group. He also joins us from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Robert Malley.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Aaron David Miller, let me begin with you. Envoy George Miller has said there has been real progress. He's talked about positive and constructive things that have been moving forward and says that so have Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, that an agreement is likely within a year. That all sounds pretty positive.
It does. I think the administration deserves a lot of credit for getting these negotiations going, particularly in creating what appears to be a reasonable foundation on which they can continue. There are two questions that need to be answered, depending on what the answers are, I think you'll be able to answer your question, Michael, as to whether or not, so will Mitchell, whether or not there'll be a serious negotiation agreement. One is, are Abbas and Netanyahu prepared to own their own talks and really invest in them and to deal head-on with the core issues that have driven the Arab-Israeli conflict and to make decisions that don't solve them but come very close to solving Jerusalem border security and refugees? That's the first question. And second, is the Obama administration willing and able to stand up and be an effective, tough, and fair and reassuring mediator? If the answers to those questions are yes, then I think you got a real negotiation, and you might even get an agreement. If the answers are no to either of them, but particularly the first, then you might as well hang a close for the season sign on the president's hopes for a two-state solution.
Now, what about the question of the moratorium on the settlements? September 26th, it's over, and Mahmoud Abbas said he will withdraw if it's over, that is, if it's not extended. So that sort of hangs over this, too, doesn't it, in a big way?
It does, but it's tough to make predictions, but I'll venture one. I do not believe that any of these three, the president, the prime minister of Israel, and the president of the Palestinian Authority, would have gone down this road and gotten through the pre-negotiation to this so-called summit, gotten through the summit itself, scheduled another round of negotiations at Sharm el-Sheikh, and committed themselves to meet every 2 weeks, if all three of them didn't have some level of confidence that on the issue of the moratorium, they had a fix. Because if they don't, this will be one of the greatest mistakes in the history of the Arab-Israeli negotiation over before it even started. So I have to assume that with some level of confidence, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I just don't believe it, that the process will continue, and by the end of September, the moratorium issue will somehow be finessed, and you'll be seeing more negotiations in October.
And yet, Alan Weiner, I was just reading an article that says that there's been more success in the past with back-channel negotiations. This is all very public.
This is very public, and I think it's a really significant step. First of all, Michael, I think, we as American observers and people who care deeply about efforts to solve this conflict, you know, tend to be hopeful and tend to see optimism. I think, you know, the mood in the region about these talks is much more skeptical, and we have to be very, very grounded in terms of setting our expectations. Back-channel relations are very helpful when the two sides really see one another as enemies, and really even the idea of talking to the other side, even considering making significant concessions to the other side is politically unacceptable at home. What's important about the nature of the process that's going on now is that both of these leaders are really saying to each other, but I think more importantly to their own populations, that they are engaged in a process that could lead to a successful outcome. I think the mood here in this regard, in terms of the way the leaders are assessing each other, is quite different from some of the other kinds of negotiation processes we've seen in the region. And I think this is really important. I think it's really important for both sides to start to characterize the other side as somebody with whom they could make peace. You know, the Israelis in particular for years and years and years have said, you know, we just don't have a Palestinian partner. We just don't have a Palestinian partner with whom we can deal. Now, that's an interesting statement. In fact, the Israelis often used to say, you know, where's our Mandela? Where's our Nelson Mandela? Where's our partner with whom we can make peace? What's interesting about that, I think, is that the Israelis misunderstood the nature of Nelson Mandela. You know, they used to think, where's the Palestinians who's going to make the concessions to us that we need to make peace? You know, Nelson Mandela was different. Nelson Mandela didn't make the concessions. In fact, Nelson Mandela was the person to whom the Afrikaners lost. And so the question is Abu Mazen the kind of leader to whom the Israelis are prepared to make the concessions that they need to make in the expectation that he, Abu Mazen, will communicate to the Israeli people that the Palestinians really have a shared vision of a two-state solution in which there is a future for the Israeli people. And I think when the two parties start to commit to this public process and describe one another as people with whom they can do business, people with whom the hopes of a peace agreement are possible, that has the possibility of beginning to change attitudes among the publics on both sides.
Well, I'm interested in the analogy you're making because Nelson Mandela certainly represented, in addition to the African National Congress, most of South Africa's black population, and one can't say the same about Abu Mazen or Mohammed Abbas, if you prefer. I mean, he has a split between Gaza and the West Bank, and that's irreconcilable, or so it would seem at this point.
You know, when I was thinking about preparing for the conversation today, Michael, I started going through as far as I'm concerned, a lot of the issues involve the way the two parties start to conceive of one another as partners, to start to conceive of one another as having a relationship, as having a vision of a future that, again, is acceptable for both sides as opposed to the narrow game of give and take in negotiations. I did start kind of making a list of some of the substantive issues, and then I came to Gaza. And my only comment on that was, oh, yeah, Gaza. It's a huge problem for the Palestinians. They're divided. They're profoundly divided, physically, politically. And that creates very, very significant constraints. Although, you know, the analogy, again, to Mandela is interesting. Mandela, faced a serious kind of challenge from the Inkatha Freedom Party, and there was sharp division even within African politics. And so sometimes, you know, having a leader who can demonstrate to his opponent that he needs more help from them because he's isolated or relatively weak at home actually isn't such a bad tactic, isn't such a bad situation to be in. He can really go to the Israelis and say, you're asking too much of me. If you do this, it will cause my system, my regime to collapse. And the Israelis will look at the situation and say, you know, he's not bluffing.
Alan Weiner, again with us from Stanford, a senior lecturer in law with the Stanford Law School. Robert Malley is Middle East and North Africa Program Director for the International Crisis Group. There was a crisis last week, Robert Malley, a terrorist attack, four dead, including a pregnant woman over on the West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas acted pretty quickly and tried to reassure the Israelis that he was certainly monitoring security in a rather profound way. At least it gave every appearance that that was the case. So how much do we still see that playing into this whole process or working against it? Because obviously those who fomented this kind of terrorism don't want this to work.
Right. And I mean, the fact that the summit went on despite those murders tells us something about the fact that both President Abbas and Prime Minister Netanyahu, in this case particularly Prime Minister Netanyahu, was prepared to go forward despite what had happened. But I think it really speaks to a broader issue, which is really what I think Alan was talking about, which is that there were many people who were present at the summit last week. There were the Americans, Tony Blair, the Egyptians or Jordanians, the president of the Palestinian Authority, the Israeli prime minister. But those who were absent may weigh more than those who were there. And you've just mentioned Hamas, and Hamas is obviously a presence on the ground, a presence politically, who's going to create huge headaches, not just for President Abbas, but also for the Israelis, as they already did. There's the issue of Gaza. Gaza was not in the room. Gaza was not represented. And yet Gaza, as we just heard, is going to weigh very heavily. The settlers, the religious right in Israel, the Syrians, the Iranians. There are many actors who are going to play a far greater role in this process than was the case in any of the peace processes of the past. They're not at the table, but it doesn't mean that they can't play a role. And in some ways, even though the rooms in Washington were crowded, the negotiators were quite lonely because so many of the actors who are going to be able to play a role were not present. And particularly if you look at it on the Palestinian side, when you try to measure those who today are in favor of what is happening, Mahmoud Abbas and a relatively narrow slice of leaders in the Palestinian Authority who still believe in this, in what's going on. And on the other side, not just Hamas, not just the Gazans who weren't there, not just every single relevant Palestinian political organization except for Fatah, except for the dominant part of the party of which Abbas is the ruler. Every other party came out in the days before the summit saying, Abbas, don't go. That's quite unprecedented. And even within Fatah, you're finding many voices, loud voices, saying that the president shouldn't have gone because he didn't obtain what he needed in terms of a settlement freeze or in terms of reference for the negotiations, and because they simply don't trust Netanyahu. That's a very different situation from the one we faced in 2000 when Yasser Arafat, for all his flaws, came to Camp David with a very broad representation and very solid legitimacy. That's not the case today. That doesn't necessarily mean that the negotiations won't succeed. In some ways, you could argue that Abbas is in a better position to reach a deal, at least to sign a piece of paper. What it does mean is that the day after an agreement, if there is an agreement, the tough job of selling it, of saying that Abbas was speaking on behalf of all Palestinians, is going to be very difficult. And you may end up with an agreement that most Palestinians, most Arabs for that matter, view as illegitimate.
Yeah, there was an article in a recent Los Angeles Times article that said that it's not only those who were absent, as you put it, but throughout the Arab street and Al Jazeera and so forth, pretty much expressing a really remarkable distrust for the Israelis and not being in favor of moving forward on this. But Michael Oren, interestingly enough, Israel's ambassador to the United States, said that what makes this a very different situation is that these Arab states seem to be united in their view that Iran is now their major enemy.
Well, I mean, that's one of the changes in the regional landscape. It's true that countries like Egypt, like Jordan, like Saudi Arabia, perhaps have a greater sense of urgency. But that we're talking about the regimes, and there's a very big disconnect, perhaps greater now than in recent memory, between the regimes and popular opinion. And I think the point that you mentioned, the article in the Los Angeles Times, if you're just going to wait the day after an agreement, if nothing changes, who is going to be sort of demonstrating on the streets in favor of the agreement on the one hand, and who is going to be speaking out against it? Those who are going to be speaking out against it today have a louder voice. It is the more militant, radical movements. It is Iran. It is Al Jazeera as a megaphone and as an echo chamber and an amplifier for all those emotions. So something's going to have to change in this process. And again, I believe, like Aaron, that there may well be a chance this time to reach an agreement. But if we don't want that agreement to simply be a piece of paper, something's going to have to change in regional attitudes. Something's going to have to change in terms of U.S. policy towards the region, bringing Syria in, trying to take care of the situation in Gaza in a wiser way. Those things that are outside the negotiating room may end up being just as important as the terms of the agreement.
And again, Robert Malley with us from Washington is Middle East and North Africa Program Director for the International Crisis Group. And Aaron David Miller is also with us from Washington. He's public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And Aaron David Miller, there's also Israel's wanting legitimacy, wanting security, of course, but wanting legitimacy as well. And according to Mahmoud Abbas, Israel's already been recognized. It was done back in 1993 with Yitzhak Rabin, with the handshake and all that. And Israel saying, well, we weren't properly recognized because it wasn't properly ratified by Palestinian institutions. This seems to me to be a major source of potential conflict going forward with this, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. If you look at the two agreements that Israel has reached, the 79 Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty and the 1994 Jordanian-Israeli peace treaty, there was never a similar request by the Israelis for this sort of formal recognition. Now, that is a consequence, I think, of two things. Number one, these were states who were not national movements seeking to become states, and borders were relatively defined, and these were powerful leaders, King Hussein, Anwar Sadat. And second, you didn't have the existential issues that exist and the identity issues that exist in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. I am absolutely persuaded that if Netanyahu, and I think very much that in this case Bibi is at war with Netanyahu, the tough-talking Likud Pal with the revisionist past is in constant conflict with Netanyahu, a man who wants to become one of the most consequential prime ministers in Israel's history and lead Israel out of the shadow of the Iranian bomb and make peace with his neighbors. If Netanyahu is to overcome Bibi in this regard, there's no question that there are two issues which are the key to extracting additional concessions from Israel. One is security, and I'm absolutely persuaded that Netanyahu will make the security land trade-off. They're going to try to set a border of a Palestinian state, and in response, Netanyahu will want a lot of encumbering security guarantees. But the second issue is the identity issue. Is the issue, however symbolic it may appear to people who don't live in the region, from the Israeli perspective, as it pertains to the Palestinians, the notion of recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people will become the sine qua non for progress. Now, the Palestinians are going to be hard-pressed to offer it up. Certainly, they will not offer it up now. They will, if they were to offer it up, they would offer it up only in exchange for their identity issue, which is some movement by the Israelis on the refugee question, because both are 48 issues, and both cut to the core of what it means to be an Israeli in this region and what it means to be a Palestinian. So you're quite right. Along with Jerusalem border security and refugees, there's a fifth issue, and it is the issue of recognition. It is not going away, and it is going to be seen by many Israelis as a legitimate aspect of the negotiations.
Well, Alan Weiner, the United States brings a lot of its reputation into this, the Obama administration specifically, and presumably it's not only going to use its good offices to move something forward here, but there's probably going to be a good deal of aid offered. I mean, there already is a good deal of aid that's being given to both sides. But don't you think that that's also in the works here, more aid to both and particularly to the Palestinians?
When we get anywhere near an end game, the answer to that has to be absolutely yes. And if you look at the substantial commitments that the United States made back at the time of the original Camp David agreement between Egypt and Israel, the U.S. commitment, both in terms of foreign aid, was significant, but also in terms of the security guarantees, were very significant, and those are clearly key issues. I do want to, really echo the last comments before finishing out on that, on the recognition issue. You know, there's a technical legal set of issues about whether the Palestinian, process properly ratified the recognition of Israel and what's in the PLO charter and these kinds of technical issues. Other people see the issue of the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, as Mr. Miller just suggested, as, largely a symbolic issue. And I think to Americans, it seems a little befuddling sometimes that this can be such a difficult issue, but it's not strictly a symbolic issue at all. I think what it really gets at is a core problem for the Israelis. You know, the Israelis are the most powerful state in the region militarily, and yet what I think we don't understand is the Israelis labor under an intense sense of insecurity, an existential sense of insecurity. And they fear that the Palestinians view the peace process as one in which an agreement will be reached that results in a two-state solution for now, but that it's an interim arrangement and that the Palestinians will continue to pursue their historical dream of a Palestinian state between the river and the sea that rivals the Israeli historical vision of a Jewish state between the river and the sea. And so what the issue of Palestinian recognition of Israel is about ultimately is a way of assuring the Israelis that the Palestinians recognize, agree, accept forever, and Robert Malley and his colleague his colleagues have written about this, a recognition that that Israel really does have a right to exist and that the Palestinians are prepared to accept that. And I think that's a huge issue. Now, whether it involves the recognition of Israel as the Jewish state in some kind of formal document or whether it concerns really the relationship that develops between the leaders and the kinds of discourse and commentary that comes out of the Palestinian and Israeli sides, I think, is as important to contributing to that.
Let me get Robert Malley to comment on this before we go to break, since you have written about it, Robert Malley.
Yeah, no, I wrote with Hussein Agha some pieces in which we're trying to look at what has stood in the way of an agreement. Now, there are many issues that stand in the way in terms of what exact division of territory will be, but one thing that the parties seem to come back to at some point is what Aaron called the 1948 issues, the issues of history, the issues of the origins of the conflict, and the deep Israeli desire to feel, or Jewish Israeli desire to feel, not just that they're accepted, that there's a piece of paper that says we recognize the state of Israel, but that Palestinians and beyond them, Arabs, understand and accept the fact that there will be a state that will be for the Jewish people, a homeland for the Jewish people, because they have this fear, and it is fed by what they hear in the Arabic media and elsewhere, that this is just the first stage, as Alan just said, and that sooner or later, Arabs will say, you know what, now we're going to the next stage, which is to wipe out the possibility of a Jewish state. And, most Palestinians believe deep inside them that the creation of the state of Israel was an illegitimate act at their expense.
On that note, we are coming up on a hard break here, and I want to give out the phone number and invite listeners to join us in this discussion. What do you think about the peace agreement or the peace process as it moves forward? You want to weigh in here? Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum at kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about peace talks. And again, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are scheduled to sit down in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt and talk some more and then go on to Jerusalem and have actually face-to-face meetings every couple of weeks in direct peace talks. We have a panel of experts looking at the likelihood of an agreement and what it will mean and talking about this from a number of dimensions. With us, Robert Malley, Middle East and North Africa Program Director with the International Crisis Group, who's in Washington this morning, and Alan Weiner, who's Senior Lecturer in Law at Stanford Law School and co-directs the Stanford Program in International Law and the Center on International Conflict and Negotiation. And Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and author of a number of books, including This Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. We're going to go to your calls here and your emails. Again, you can also post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or you can email us forum@kqed.org or grab a hold of a phone line when one becomes available. Your participation is certainly welcome and invited, and our toll-free number is available to you whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Just wondering, before we go to calls and emails and find out what our listeners have to say and ask, Aaron David Miller, there's a lot politically at stake here, not only in the United States, perhaps for President Obama, who has gone ahead with this right before the election in November, but certainly also in Israel and in Palestine, in the West Bank. And it's going to take a lot of courage, even beyond what courage is taking to sit down for these leaders. You were talking before about Bibi versus Netanyahu. There's some who feel that if Benjamin Netanyahu moves toward a real peace and goes toward the two-state solution, which he's now said he's in favor of, and pretty much freezes on the settlements. He's got all this on the right from Lieberman and others who will, well, he'll lose his coalition politically. I mean, that's what some of the smart money is saying at this point.
I mean, I think the existential risks are much greater, obviously, for Abbas and Netanyahu. And that's why it has required in the past leaders who have been masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their own constituencies. I mean, truly, every breakthrough in this process has been of a heroic character. We have powerful men, Sadat, Begin, Rabin, Arafat in this first incarnation, King Hussein, who had legitimacy, moral authority, and a capacity, at least in the beginning, to take their constituencies with them. Now, in the case of Sadat and Rabin, it cost them both their lives. So, you know, we have our own existential realities in the United States, far too many assassinated presidents, but it's nothing like the existential reality that exists out there. So that's why, my pessimism, and I suspect it's kind of a sober analysis, is rooted in the reality that, at least at the moment, it really requires leaders who are prepared to stand up and to command. And this is where things begin to break down for me. To deal with Jerusalem, to deal with refugees, to deal with June 67 borders and the identity issues, it really is going to require transformations. Begin was transformed. Sadat made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Sharon was transformed. He, the master architect of the settlement enterprise, withdrew from Gaza, dismantled settlements, and withdrew the IDF. Rabin was transformed. These are all hawks on the Israeli side who underwent conversions, not for sentimental reasons, but for reasons of national interest and perhaps to some degree external pressure. Whether or not Netanyahu can make the same evolution, the same transformation at the same time while he deals with Iran's quest for enough fissile material to, at some point, make a nuclear weapon with Hamas and Hezbollah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, it's also a kind of Nixon goes to China when you talk about these leaders like Begin and Netanyahu. I'm looking at an email from a listener named Joseph who says, I believe that Avigdor Lieberman and his pessimistic rhetoric is possibly the biggest threat to the current round of peace talks. The only way for Netanyahu to make the deal that needs to be made is to dissolve the current government and form a new one with Kadima. Only then will the government be able to make the painful but sensible decisions and concessions that lasting peace will require. One of our other listeners, Simon, writes, and Alan Weiner, you might want to comment on this. He says, because you were making analogies before to the need for a Mandela, he says, Marwan Barghouti's imprisonment, he may be released. Isn't he the Mandela the Israelis are looking for?
Well, again, I think the Israelis, when they talk about the Mandela they're looking for, is somebody who they can make the painful concessions to, not, as the Israelis think of it, the person who will make and deliver the concessions to them. I do think, Abu Mazen is not a dynamic, is not a powerful political figure. He has a divided society over which he governs. But there have been some very, very significant developments on the Palestinian side, and they've happened under Abu Mazen and Prime Minister Salim Sayyad. And that is, you see for the first time the development of some institutions in the Palestinian Authority. You see the development of economic institutions. You see the development of some really genuine political institutions. You know, Arafat was, as Mr. Miller suggested, somebody who was able to come to the table at the first point, but he was a person who came from the tradition of being a resistance fighter, not somebody who came from the tradition of governing. And I think that was one of the factors that really ultimately contributed to his inability to agree to what was offered, at the end of the Clinton administration, and to deliver, to do the politics within his own society, very difficult politics that would have been required, to say an agreement like this, although it requires us to abandon many of the things we've talked about and dreamed of for our whole lifetimes, is one that will be better for our people. We are moving a little bit away from personalist politics in the Palestinian Authority. I actually think that's a good thing. I think as the Palestinian society becomes a more normal, a more modern, a more institutionalized society, the capacity for doing politics, for having a process by which leaders are able to sell an agreement to their constituency, becomes more possible. I also think it makes the Palestinian side one that the Israelis are more likely to think is the kind of society that they can live in peace with. You know, one of the things that was a big failure, I think, out of Oslo was we agreed that we would have the Palestinians assume control for significant segments of their society, but there was no effort to really develop governance and institutions. The only political and governing institution that the Palestinians developed was a security apparatus. And what the Israelis saw on the other side was an increasingly armed but still seething and angry population that was focused on one thing, which was the realization of the Palestinian national project and Palestinian national aspirations. Now perhaps the Israelis see on the other side a society in which people are focused more on the same kinds of things that Israelis are focused on, making their lives better, building a better world for their children than they have for themselves, than on this single issue of pursuing their nationalist project. Barghouti is clearly somebody who is an interesting figure. He speaks Hebrew. He understands the Israelis very well. He has credibility as a political prisoner with his own constituency. So I think he could be an important ingredient in this mix. I agree with Mr. Miller that personalities, leadership is incredibly important here. But without an underlying set of institutions to implement and to develop a peace agreement, I think leadership alone won't solve the problem. And I think there are some positive steps happening in the West Bank.
Well, we have a lot of calls, and I want to go to them. Before I do, though, Robert Malley, I'm interested in your response to one of our listeners who has emailed in a question, a listener named Marshall, who says, how closely linked are Gaza and the West Bank? Meaning, is it possible to achieve peace in the West Bank without the cooperation of Gaza?
We always have an agreement that would apply to the West Bank and would leave Gaza off for the day when there's some form of reconciliation between among Palestinians. It would be a vulnerable, fragile peace, but you could have an agreement that would be implemented in the West Bank. It's not something I think most Palestinians would want, because they are one people despite the divisions. It would make it very hard to decide on some issues. For example, if there are going to be land swaps between Israel and the Palestinians, some of those swaps are supposed to be in the neighborhood of Gaza. How would you do that if Gaza were under Hamas's control, even as the West Bank were under Fatah's control? So it can be done to some extent, but it certainly is extremely complicated. And from an Israeli point of view, probably not something they'd want to see, making peace with half the Palestinian people while the other half is excluded.
And on we go to your calls now. Mark is first up here. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks very much for taking my call, and really enjoy the program. I'd like to ask the panelists, what they think about the possibility of some novel, perhaps entirely out-of-the-box solution. This entire process and the conflict has been going on for so long, so many decades, without any clear resolution in sight, with the same sort of ideas being tried. Just as a thought, kind of a far-fetched example perhaps, what if Jerusalem, which both parties want to claim as the capital, and perhaps both parties very much want for the other side to not have as the capital, what if Jerusalem, for instance, was administered entirely as a neutral territory, say, I don't know, by the Swiss, and served as a de facto capital for both Palestinians and Israel, or something along those lines. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm going to refer that to you, Aaron David Miller, since you've been involved in so many negotiations, and Jerusalem obviously has come up in so many.
Well, Rob will have a comment on this as well, because this is his involvement in Camp David. But I don't – look, if there were novel solutions, I think they would have been tried by now. And the reason they haven't is because in the end – on the issue of Jerusalem, it really comes down to possession. I mean, the notion that somehow you can internationalize or neutralize a capital which both sides claim, not to mention the issue of religious sovereignty, is a fundamental departure point from what the parties want. Now, there may be international components of a regime that could be laid on in order to finesse the sovereignty issue. But in the end, Israelis will control the part of Jerusalem that is their capital, and the Palestinians will control the part of Jerusalem that is theirs. I do not believe there are New Age solutions to the basic issue of political sovereignty. So, I mean, I think from their perspective, Jerusalem was never to be shared. It was to be possessed in the name of God, in the name of religion, in the name of the tribe. Getting them off of that is going to require some measure of possession, and not relegating the capital to make it an international or an open city.
Let me bring in more of our callers, and I want to get to Max next. Max, join us.
Good morning. Thank you for a good program. I have a couple of comments or questions, really. The first one has to do with the Saudi time. I read Friedman's column today. He said, look, maybe it's time that this proposal be revisited. It would have the advantage, as I understand it, of having the backing of the Arab League, which would be very important to get this thing moving. That's my first question. My other question has to do with a piece that was written maybe a week ago, but I suspect by an Israeli, by a fellow by the name of Taub, T-A-U-B, if I'm mangling the pronunciation there of the last name, very pessimistic. He said, look, the logic of posture of the right in Israel is it has to do with the implementation of a one-state solution, which would be really disastrous for the Israeli state and Zionism. I'd like to take your comments off the air. Thank you again for taking my call and for a good program.
Thank you for that. And Robert Malley, the Saudi proposal coming back perhaps on some level? Or?
Well, I mean, the Saudi proposal, which is the unanimous Saudi offer of normalization with Israel if Israel were to withdraw from the territories occupied in 67. It was obviously an important element, but I think it goes to the broader point, and I want to come back to what Aaron just said, because I have a slight disagreement with him on this on the broad issue. I think that to some extent the peace process is suffering from arthritis, in the sense that both sides have said now for many years what their position is, and it's going to be very hard if you simply stick to the same ways of doing things to get one side to move well beyond where it has gone. For example, I cannot imagine President Abbas going further than he went when he was negotiating with Prime Minister Olmert, and that was not far enough for the Israelis. Nor can I imagine Prime Minister Netanyahu going further than Prime Minister Olmert did, and that was not enough for the Palestinians. So they're going to have to break from the mold of simply looking at the old solution and saying, well, let's push it a bit more in this direction because one side won't accept it, or more in that direction because the other side won't accept it. I think one is going to have to inject some new ideas. Our peace proposal was one, but there are a number. I think that listen to what Prime Minister Netanyahu said last week. He said we have to think out of the box. I think what he's getting at, and giving him the benefit of the doubt, is let's try to find new ways of resolving old problems, but perhaps finding a solution is not that different from what Aaron and I worked on in 2000 and since, but frame it differently, find ways to address some of the existential 1948 issues that we talked about earlier, so that both leaders at the end of the day could come and tell their constituents, I've achieved something that none of my predecessors was able to achieve. Whether it has to do with recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, whether it has to do with recognition of the plight of the refugees, whether it has to do with something having, related to Jerusalem, some idea that would allow both sides to come out of this victorious. Because if you simply stick to the ways of way we address it in the past, it is very much a zero-sum game. One side will do better than it did in the past, and the other side will do worse.
Well, let me go back to you on this, Alan Weiner, because Max's second question had to do with obstacles to peace, and I think he alluded to an article by somebody named Taub. Don't know who that is, but certainly he's raising what in many people's minds is the central question of the role of the right in Israel, the right, that is, right to Bibi Netanyahu, and also the settlers who are not necessarily going to be willing to give up the land that is going to be necessary to broker toward peace.
Michael, it's a huge issue. The withdrawal from Gaza for the Israelis was a very, very difficult process that in some ways represented a near existential threat to the Israeli state, and that involved the movement of 8,000 settlers from Gaza. Some of the proposals that have been on the table involved the Israelis, keeping maybe 5 or 6% of the territory of the West Bank, which would cover 80 to 85% of the settlers. Well, if you do the math, that involves talking about moving 50,000. 100,000, 50,000 settlers, maybe more, relocating them. And that will be a tremendous challenge. I think
it's not only the movement of the settlers. If you read some of the more conservative editorials in Israel, they argue that leaving Gaza not only allowed for Hamas to become victorious in a democratic election, but also allowed for rockets to be lobbed at them on a pretty consistent basis.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, the security arrangements, the Israelis will, as Mr. Miller suggested, make sure that any agreement is very, very heavily encumbered with security arrangements. It would be a negotiated settlement, not simply a unilateral withdrawal. And I think that the Israelis are not going to pull out of Gaza without security, out of the West Bank without security guarantees to make sure that rockets are not lobbed. But it's a huge problem. Clearly, in response to a question that you asked earlier, Netanyahu will lose substantial or at least significant portions of his coalition if he does any agreement that's along the lines of what is even conceivable as being achievable. Now, the question is whether he's willing to make the trade-off and say, okay, I will reform my coalition with Kadima or with the left, put together a national unity government, have a national referendum that reflects what we are told or what I believe to be true, is that the majority of Israeli citizens, in fact, want a peace agreement that's along the lines of what's been on the table, really, for over a decade.
We've seen through polls the majority of Israeli citizens want a peace agreement, and the majority of Palestinian citizens want a peace agreement. But
we have is powerful, powerful spoilers on each side, who make it impossible for that kind of majoritarian will to kind of be realized. And again, the question is whether we have the politics and the kind of relationship between the two sides, the kind of political process between the two sides that emboldens the centrists on in each of the publics and makes it easier to isolate the spoilers.
Let me go to another caller. Damien, join us. I think you're right on point here about the settlers, Damien.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. And yes, you sort of answered that question. I do take an exception to what Mr. Weiner said regarding society. I'm very sure that the Palestinian mothers and fathers want their children to grow up in a better society, as evidenced by the fact that the Palestinians are the most educated Arabs in the region. So I'm not quite sure that the Israeli viewpoint that they have a seething militant group next to them is quite correct. In fact, if anything, I think being attacked by Israelis sort of helps that environment become seething. But they are wanting to have a better life for their future. And the other thing is the settlers themselves. Explain to me how the Israelis view the settlers, and I've never understood this, how they view the settlers as a legitimate people that essentially go onto other people's land. And I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
All right. Who wants to step forward here from our panel and answer that question?
Well, let me take the first one, Michael. This is Alan Weiner, since it responded to a comment that I made. I certainly agree that the majority of Palestinians, you know, want a better life, want the same things that Israelis want, and want what we want. The question is, what is the perception on the Israeli side of the Palestinians? And I think there, the Israelis, you know, both sides have spent so much time demonizing the other that the Israelis don't see the Palestinians as people who want to have a normal society. I think that's an Israeli perception, and I think we're seeing some changes in the West Bank under Prime Minister Fayyad that are maybe contributing to some changes in that attitude.
But there is, in Israel, and perhaps Aaron David Miller, the way of answering that second question, there is, first of all, the political side of the necessity to, how shall we put it, acquiesce where religious zealots are concerned. I mean, that's been a pattern. For example, they don't have to serve in the military and all of those kinds of things. But there's also the sense of many Israelis, and particularly those who follow Lieberman, that this is all kind of manifest destiny, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Israel's a deeply divided country, and most elections basically are 40-40 representing a kind of, I don't know, left-of-center view, and the other 40 right-of-center, and then are 20% of the public usually decides the election. And in a coalition government, you know, you've had 32 Israeli governments since 1948. The average lifespan of each government is 1.8 years. So the reality is that in a coalition government in a small country, you're going to have diverse groups who make their views known. My own view here, and people spend their lives studying the settlers as a constituency, and it's a complicated subject. But my own view is that the vast majority of Israelis really are centrist. And I think what drives them is less support for this millennial sort of let's create a new manifest destiny. I mean, Sharon broke that mold. Sharon broke it in Sinai. Begin broke it in Sharon broke it in Gaza. Begin broke it in Sinai. Rabin broke it with Oslo, and even Netanyahu, the first Likud prime minister to withdraw from West Bank territory, broke it. I don't think it's that so much. What I think drives the Israelis is a fundamental fear that their neighbors...
Security.
Yes, that their neighbors... And by the way, as far as I'm concerned, we're way beyond the sentimental aspects of peacemaking. We're not talking about peace. Egypt and Israel have had peace since 1979. That's not peace in the sense that we have it with the Canadians or even the Mexicans. That's a political agreement. That's important, by the way. But most Israelis, I do not believe, are terribly impressed by whether or not Dubai decides to allow overflight rights. I think what drives the Israelis in this environment are several factors. One is the looming threat of Iran. A second are non-state actors, Hamas and Hezbollah, functioning in non-states, Lebanon and Palestine, that do pose relative degrees of threats to them. So I think what the key to this whole thing, it seems to me, is whether or not you can have Arab partners who are prepared to stand up and in response to what I think will be excruciatingly painful concessions on the part of Israelis, make a symmetrical nod both in terms of security arrangements as well as the very important issue of recognition. It's not love. Forget love. If the Israelis want love, they should move, because they're never going to be loved by their neighbors. They need to be respected and, in some respects, left alone. They're not going to be admired in a public sense, and they're not going to be loved. And the key to being respected, seems to me, are two issues. One is security, and the other, as Alan has alluded to, and Rob as well, some kind of recognition which answers the mail. You do those two things on the Arab-Palestinian side, you can even turn me into a believer. Again.
They're more important than border settlements or Jerusalem or refugees or security?
I think that borders... border settlements, Jerusalem, and refugees are going to have to be resolved. The Israelis are going to have to make extremely painful concessions and decisions in all of those areas. But in return, in order to extract those, you're going to have to really up the ante in terms of the other two dimensions, security and recognition.
Well, final question here as we come toward the end of this hour. And Robert Malley, let me start with you. Will these talks really survive all these obstacles we've talked about? And will they, in your judgment, bear fruit?
You know, we could. I can make a case, a positive case, a negative case, and I'm not sure that it would amount to all that much. There's a lot of reasons to be skeptical, and there's some reasons to be hopeful as well. I think the main thing job today is to identify what the obstacles are, and I think we've done a pretty good job in this discussion of identifying both the elephants in the room, with Hamas or Gaza, the complex substantive issues of recognition and acceptance of the of responsibility for what happened to Palestinian refugees. There's so many of these dimensions, identifying them and then coming up with the best answers, the best way to overcome them. We could waste our time deciding whether we're optimistic or pessimistic. I think the better thing to do, let's see where the hurdles are, and let's think of creative, new, and wiser ways of overcoming them.
And can we really move out of the box, I guess, is also sort of the question hovering over this discussion. Ellen Weiner, what do you think?
Well, I think being optimistic about the prospects, given the history in the region, requires a degree of naivete that shouldn't be expected even of law professors. But I do think that there are at least some hopeful elements here, and I'm encouraged by the way in which the key leaders are engaging with one another. You know, unlike Rob, I think what a peace agreement often requires people to do is to accept today the things that they said in the past were unacceptable. So I don't think we're going to solve the problem by changing the percentage of land allocated to each side and coming up with a new formula on refugees. What's going to happen is we're going to have the existence, the emergence of a relationship between the two sides in which things that couldn't be agreed to in the past can be agreed to now. Are we there yet? Again, it's a long shot, but I do think there are some encouraging signs in the way these two parties are now engaging with one another in
well,
this process.
Seconds left. Final word from you, Aaron David Miller.
Look, if Abbas and Netanyahu are prepared to own these, you got a chance. And if the administration is prepared to stand up, be patient. It's going to be a long movie. Be tough. Don't be anybody's lawyer. Your client is the agreement and the Israelis and the Palestinians. And in the end, you're going to have to be tough, because if this works, nobody's going to plant a tree in your honor.
Thank you to Robert Malley of the International Crisis Group, to Ellen Weiner of the Stanford Program in International Law and Stanford Law School, and Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Again, his book, among others, is The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We appreciate your listenership. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Another hour of Forum coming your way. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.